Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. Last week, we continued our series that we are calling The Hills to Die On regarding the JFK assassination. One of the biggest hills that I choose to die on in this case is the fact that we know with absolute certainty that there was someone impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald for weeks or possibly months leading up to the assassination. There is not a single doubt in my mind that someone was impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald and setting up a narrative for him for some time before the assassination. I found during my research that many of the sightings of a second Oswald was seen by multiple witnesses. This was not just some random person who resembled Oswald. In most instances, witnesses reported that the man they identified as Lee Harvey Oswald provided specific details about Oswald's life, such as his family and his past, that made it clear he wanted people to believe he was Oswald, even if he wasn't the real one. This person that wanted people to think he was Oswald was seen at the gun range several times, a furniture store, a car dealership, applying for a job at a couple of radio stations around the Dallas area. He also spoke with Laura Cottrell at the Texas Employment Commission, trying to convince her that he was Lee Harvey Oswald, when she knew it wasn't the real Lee Oswald, because she had spoken to him on several occasions. This person also applied for a job at the Hill Machinery Company and put down the name Oswald on his application, and his Marine service was also listed on the form.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
In some recent episodes, we looked at impersonations of Lee Harvey Oswald for weeks and months before the assassination. We heard about sightings of two Oswalds in Dallas just a couple days before the assassination, on a city bus, at the Dobbs House restaurant. And then we heard the incredible and sad story of Ralph Leon Yates as he picked up the Oswald double on Wednesday, November 20th, giving him a ride to the corner of Elm and Houston, which happens to be the location of the Texas School Book Depository building. These are just a few places that the person was seen impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald, when we know for a fact that the real Lee Harvey Oswald was present at other places during these times. In episode 89, we looked at the sightings of the Oswald double on the day of the assassination, possibly in Dealey Plaza, the site of the J.D. Tippit shooting, the Texas Theater, and in an El Chico parking lot at about 2 p.m. on the day of the assassination, after the real Lee Harvey Oswald had already been arrested and in police custody. Conveniently, this El Chico parking lot where the second Oswald was last seen by T.F. White in Dallas was only about a block away from the Texas Theater. In last week's episode, we heard the incredible story of a former U.S. Air Force Sergeant, Robert Vinson, who claimed to have witnessed an interesting event on the day of the Kennedy assassination. The interlocking testimonies of Sergeant Vinson and numerous others that we have spoken about in recent episodes may have given us a backstage view of the double Oswald drama directed by the CIA in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas on November 22, 1963. Their stories fit too easily and make too much sense for there not to be nothing there. According to Robert Vinson, he traveled by bus on the morning of November 22, 1963, from Washington, D.C. to the nearby Andrews Air Force Base, with the intention of hitching a ride on an Air Force plane to Ant Air Force Base in Colorado Springs, Colorado. He was told that the only available flight was on a cargo plane heading to Lowry Air Force Base in Denver, about 50 miles north of Colorado Springs. He and two pilots were the only people on the plane, which lacked the usual Air Force markings. Its only identification was on its tail, a rust-brown graphic of an egg-shaped earth crossed by white grid marks. At some point during the flight, the pilot announced over the intercom that, quote, the president was shot at 12:29 p.m., end quote. The plane then immediately turned and headed south. At about 3:30 p.m., Vincent recognized the city of Dallas. The plane landed on a rough patch of land close to the Trinity River, between downtown Dallas and the Oak Cliff section of Dallas. This is the section of Dallas where the real Lee Harvey Oswald lived, and J.D. Tippit was shot and killed, and Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested in the Texas Theater. All of this occurred in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas. With the plane's engine still running, two men in beige overalls got on board, not speaking to each other or acknowledging Vincent's presence. The plane then quickly took off again and landed shortly after dusk on a proper runway. The two passengers and the two pilots all rapidly left the plane. Vincent alone made his way to a building, where he was told to his surprise that he had landed not in Denver, but at Roswell Air Force Base in New Mexico. He made his way to Colorado Springs the next day. Watching the television coverage of the assassination, he was struck by the remarkable resemblance between Lee Harvey Oswald and one of the two men who had got on the plane in Dallas. His wife, Roberta, encouraged him to keep quiet about what he had seen for his own safety. About a year later, Robert Vincent was summoned back to Washington, D.C., and from there to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. He spent 5 days there, undergoing psychological and physical tests, after which he was formally invited to join the CIA. He would decline the offer. Early in 1965, the Air Force did not ask Vincent, but told him that he would be working in an administrative role for the CIA at a secret base north of Las Vegas. At the base, he discovered other planes which contained the same unusual markings as the plane he had taken on that day of the assassination. Vincent believed he was forced to take the job with the CIA so they could keep an eye on him. After a year and a half working for the CIA, Robert Vincent retired. For nearly 30 years, he told very few people about his experiences on the day of the Kennedy assassination. After the passage of the JFK Records Act in 1992, Vincent consulted his congressional representative, who informed him that he was now free from any restrictions imposed by his former employment. In 1993, Vincent gave an interview to a local Wichita, Kansas television station. The ensuing publicity brought him to the attention of a local lawyer, James Johnson, who cooperated with journalist John Rowe on a 2003 book titled Flight from Dallas, New Evidence of CIA Involvement in the Murder of President John F. Kennedy. In 2008, author and investigative journalist James Douglas did exactly what we have done on this podcast the last several episodes. He takes Robert Vincent's account and places it next to those of several other witnesses to form a consistent narrative of events immediately after the assassination. He would release a book in 2008 titled JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. I sat down with Robert Vincent in his home in Wichita, Kansas in January of 1998, and he shared with me his story. I put Robert Vincent in the same class as I would Ed Hoffman, whom I spent a lot of time with. A very good and honorable man that saw something he was not supposed to see on that afternoon in 63. And for many years, he was too scared to go on record with what he had saw. While both men told others around them immediately after the assassination what they saw, they were both told to keep quiet for their own safety and the safety of their family. This week, we're going to hear part two of the interview that we started last week that was done with Robert Vincent himself back on November 2nd, 1996. It is the first time Vincent would allow anyone to record his statement about his life and what he witnessed on November 22, 1963. This is a very historic interview that doesn't get the attention it deserves because many people discount Vincent's story. I'm not one of those people. Here's the final part of Robert Vincent's interview.
Mr. Vincent, we have here before us some aerial photographs, do we not?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. And you recognize these, do you not?
Yes, this is an area south of Dallas along the Trinity River.
All right. And in the upper left-hand corner, it shows 4-64, which we've interpreted to mean April of 64.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. And would you point again to the area where you believe this plane landed?
I believe this plane landed in this area right here.
And which you have just pointed to.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Because I was sitting on the other side, the plane was going this way, and I was sitting on the north side then, or northeast side, and I could look out the window and see the skyline downtown Dallas. And when we turned around and went this way, and you could look out the window and see the downtown area.
All right.
On my right-hand side.
So as you came in, you were heading in what direction?
I was heading in southeast direction.
And when you took off, the plane was headed
in northwest.
All right.
Northwest section.
Now, this particular aerial photograph also shows some other configuration of the Trinity River and the floodplain, which I'm pointing to now. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, the next aerial that we have here is dated January 4, 1964, and it also is an aerial photograph of the area where you say this plane landed. Is that correct?
Yes.
And would you point again to the same area? You are doing so now.
This area here.
And this photograph shows the area to the northwest of where the C-54 landed of the Trinity floodplain. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Now I will show you two additional illustrations marked the one at the bottom, 1963 Dallas, which is my description of the map. This is a city and street map of Dallas, and you have seen this before, have you
yes.
not?
Mm-hmm.
And have you placed on this street map with yellow markings where the plane landed?
This area here.
All right, and you are again pointing to the area previously identified on the two aerial photographs. Now at the top is a Dallas 1995 map, and that is a description that I personally placed on there. And you have placed again the yellow line showing where the C-54 landed.
They landed. Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, Mr. Vinson, have you any reason to doubt where this plane landed other than what you have told us here today?
No, I do not.
All right. Now, let's commence again with your return to your home by public bus from the Roswell Air Force Base.
As I stated before, I left Roswell about 11 o'clock, and I rode all night. I got home in Colorado Springs, or at the bus station. My wife picked me up about 8:30. Right in that area. It was after 8 o'clock. And I went on to the house. This was Saturday morning. And went on to the house and didn't think any more about it. And Monday I went to work and nobody said anything or done anything. And we went through the holidays. I think we took a little leave and went to Houston. And
let me ask you this question at this point. When you saw over the television media or in newspapers, whatever, and saw this person who was identified as Oswald, did you then develop some caution or suspicion about this flight you had been on?
I told my wife. I said, you know, those two guys looked a lot alike, the ones we picked up in Dallas.
Referring to Oswald.
Yeah, and she said, oh, it couldn't be. She said, you know, they shot him. And I said, well, you know, I kind of just passed it off. And didn't bother me anymore.
All right. Go ahead.
Then, as first of the year, I wasn't too long after the first of the year, all of a sudden I received a promotion and came down from Washington. And they went ahead and had a big filming and everything of the promotion and made a big deal of it.
Of your promotion?
Yeah.
And when you say they, who?
That was a colonel, one colonel and a general, General Latta, Colonel Burton, Captain Cole, and most of the officers there.
And now this took place on what base?
Hint Air Force Base.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
And then later on, it was about June, or around June, May or June.
1964.
My neighbor came over and asked my wife, says, what have you and Bob done? And she said, well, I hope nothing. And he says, well, the neighborhood has been flooded with personnel wanting to know all about you, asking questions of all the neighbors. And she said, well, I don't know anything about it. She says, we haven't done anything, and as far as I know, there's nothing, you know, to hide. Then there was a little later on, Captain Cole gave us some documents to read and fill out and sign. And at first I thought it was maybe just an update of my security clearance, because it was kind of similar, you wanting background information and all the data on you. And I had a crypto clearance, which is the highest you could carry. And
you had this clearance at this time for what reason? Why would you have had a crypto clearance, as you put it?
I was handling top secret documents
for the Air Force. For NORAD.
NORAD.
All right. Mm-hmm. I understand. Go ahead.
And then after this June encounter with a neighbor, we filled out these forms and gave them all the information. But there was one of the forms that my wife said she wasn't going to sign. It was the secrecy document that they wanted us to fill out, saying that you wouldn't divulge any information from here on regarding any military type operations or any knowledge that came to you that was determined to be secret or top secret. And she didn't want to sign it. And then I told Captain Cole, I said, why does she have to sign that?
I'm sorry, you told which captain?
Captain Cole.
Okay.
I said, why does she have to sign that? She's not wanting to sign it. He said, well, they have to have this information. And it doesn't mean anything other than just, you know.
That
I guess he thought it was a security clearance, too.
All right.
And so she finally relented and signed it. And I turned them in. And then November, I got another, just got a set of orders through the mail. I mean, through the office there, Captain Cole. He handled all of this.
This would be an Air Force order?
Well, I don't know where it was or not, because the order read that I was to report to Washington, D.C., and all I had was a telephone number.
All right. Now, do you have a copy of that order that you have just described?
Yes, there should be a copy there. Let's see, that would be... Yes, under instructions here. And
all right, this document carries the number 10 in the lower right-hand corner. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And it's a two-page document?
Two-page document.
This order then directed you to do what?
To report to Washington, D.C., and to call this telephone number when I arrived there.
All right, which I'm placing this on the easel. Where was the phone number that you were told to call?
I believe it's right here.
All right. The printing is very pale on this, but you have the copy of the order in your possession, of which we've made this copy.
Yes, I do.
All right.
Which is legible.
Yes. All right. And did you know what this was all about?
No, no one could tell me.
You were to go to Washington, D.C. and call a phone number.
Just call this number, and then I would get further instructions from there.
All right. So when then did you comply with that order?
That was...
The order was dated November 25, 1964, in the upper right-hand corner.
November...
1964.
I believe I left there on Sunday after at Air Force Base, which was actually Peterson Field, where we flew out of. And I flew out of there on Sunday afternoon and arrived, I believe I arrived there that same Sunday afternoon.
Arrived at what
base? Andrews Air Force Base. And I went over to, went into Washington, D.C., and I called this number. And they told me to report to the first barracks after I entered the gate at Fort Myer, Virginia. And I reported there, and they told me that they signed me a room. A guy came in and signed me a room, and said a bus will be here tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock and to get on it. So
at that point, did you know where you were supposed to go on that bus?
No.
All right.
So still didn't know.
No one had ever, up to this point, given you any information about why you were ordered to go to D.C. and bivouac at Fort Myer or get on this bus the next morning?
No. I asked General Latta. He said he didn't know anything about it. I asked Colonel Burton. He said he didn't know anything.
Now, these gentlemen were...
Or my supervisors back at Ant Air Force Base.
Right. Go ahead.
And I reported out there. Got up Monday morning, took the bus. The bus left then, and there were some other gentlemen got on, and they were dressed, some of them in civilian clothes, some in uniform, some Army, some Navy, and we drove out to a place called Langley, Virginia. And when we started entering, somebody said, "Hey, this is CIA headquarters." So we drove on in. They stopped us at the gate, and the bus driver gave them a slip or something. I didn't get to see what it actually was. It was just a piece of paper. And they drove on in. We got out down there, and we were just kind of standing around, and a gentleman came out in civilian clothes, said, "Follow me," and took us on inside and took us to this one room. And
was this in a tall building, a one-story building? What
no,
type
it's
of building?
About a two-story, I think it was a three-story building that we were in. And I believe this was on the second floor that we went to. And it was a pretty good-sized room. They took us in there and started, first thing we did was they started testing us with a written examination.
All right, up to this point, had there ever been any official information given to you or to the group that you heard identifying that as CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia?
No.
All right. Did you ever see, up to this point, any signs or guideposts or anything like that indicating that this was CIA headquarters?
No, I don't remember seeing any, and other than this is a restricted area, keep out. There's a lot of those signs.
All right.
And then this test must have been about 400 questions, and it dealt with, do you hate your father? Did you hate your mother? Did they beat you? You know, just psychological, I think.
All right. They were written questions?
Right. Written questions.
And you were asked to answer them?
Yes.
All right.
And it took about 4 hours to go through this whole test. Then that afternoon, they started our physical. And at about 5 o'clock, we finished. Of course, they took us downstairs and fed us at noon in a cafeteria. And about 4 o'clock that afternoon, we all got back on the bus and went back to those barracks at Fort Myer, Virginia. Nobody said anything. I think they were about as stunned as I was and didn't know what was going on. And the next morning, Tuesday morning, we got up and we went back out there on a bus, looked like the same. We went through some more psychological testing, and then that afternoon they kept giving us physical. This was a real tough physical they run us through. And then on we went back in, spent the night again, went back on Wednesday. I believe that was the morning they gave me the lie detector test. I spent about 2 hours in there. And then I came out and spent some more time on another a short test, psychological test, I would call it. And then that afternoon, that's Wednesday, I took some more physical, part of the physical. And then I believe it was on Thursday, we came back in and then went back. And then on Thursday, we had some more testing and finished up the physical.
What type of testing on this last day?
It was a written psychological type testing.
All right.
A lot of this was repeat but the questions wasn't in the same order. They were switched around. Different areas would be like, did you hate your mother or her father? Would be at the end of it. And at first, it would be at first, and they would have mixed up.
All right.
So then we went back Thursday night, and then on Friday morning, we went back out there, and we sort of hung around. We went to the cafeteria, had coffee, and then about 1 o'clock, they took us into this room that had a big U table in it, sort of like a horseshoe. And
so this would have been a large conference room?
Been a real large conference room.
All right.
And they took us in one at a time, and there was individuals sitting around this conference room. It was dark. You couldn't recognize the individuals behind it. It was kind of dark back there, but you were out in an open area. They could see you, but a little hard to see them.
All right. Were these individuals around this table in any type of uniform?
No. Most of them were civilians. There might have been one or two in uniform.
All right.
And they started asking me, would you like to go work with us? But they never did tell me who us was. And I told them, no, I would not like to go because I had bought my home in Colorado Springs. I planned to retire there. And that I had a job lined up.
Did you know where they wanted you to go?
No, they never told me where this would be. Other than they would like to, and I said, well, I own my home. Well, we can take care of that. I said, well, what do you mean to take care of it? Well, you'll be compensated for it. And I said, oh, okay. And then says, now, are you sure you wouldn't like to go? And I said, no. They kept insisting that I would like to go, and I said, no, I want to retire in Colorado Springs. My wife wanted to live there. She thought it was a beautiful little city, and when we got transferred there, that was the greatest thing happened. And I kept insisting that I didn't want to go, and kept saying, well, we'll make it worth your while. And I said, no, I'd prefer just to finish out my term in NORAD. And so finally they told me, says, you know how to get back to the your bus station from, you know, the barracks? And I said, no, I don't. I said, so they said, well, you can go out here, and there's a bus out there, and he'll take you back, he'll take you to the airport, which was between Washington and Baltimore.
Which airport?
I'm trying to think of the name of it. Baltimore, it's a joint, Baltimore and Washington Airport.
All right.
It's south of Baltimore.
All right.
And so this bus took us up to another area and left us there. And pretty soon another bus came and picked us up and took us on over. Not all of us, just some of us, took us on up to the airport. And I went in there and got a ticket. Now, I had a ticket. I took the shuttle there, and they had a ticket for me to come back. So I went in and got a ticket, or had my ticket, to catch the airline back that night. I think it left at 7 o'clock. And I got on it and went back to Colorado Springs.
Now, this airline, was it a commercial public airline?
Yes.
All right.
Commercial public.
But when you received your orders originally to go to Fort Myer, was that by military transport or by commercial?
Military transport, the shuttle run I had talked about earlier.
All right. Now, during the whole time that you were in the CIA facility in Langley, Virginia, did anyone there ever identify themselves to you, either by name or identification tag or anything of that nature?
No, I just had a good idea where it was at. Since I had worked for the Office of Special Investigation over in Washington, D.C., over at Bowling Air Force Base, we received a lot of documents from them relating to background investigations. And I knew where it was at after they took me out there.
All right. The office.
But they never did tell me who they were.
All right. When you say the Office of Air Force Investigation, mm-hmm. You worked in that office?
Yes.
And what did you do there?
I gathered documents for background investigations.
Of Air Force personnel?
Well, civilians and Air Force personnel.
And that would have been what period of time that you did that search?
That would have been in 1954 to 1955.
All right. And from that experience and the documents that came across your desk, you were aware that the Langley, Virginia facility was a CIA facility.
Yes, and they had a sign up outside that it said Langley, Virginia.
All right.
That's all it said.
That was on the highway?
That was on the highway.
All right. All right, go ahead.
Let's see, I was...
You had just taken the commercial airliner.
I'm taking a commercial flight home. And I arrived back in Colorado. And I thought pretty much everything was settled. That, you know, told them I didn't want to go. I almost insisted I didn't want to go. Then when my wife asked me, she said, how did it go? And I said, well, I just kept insisting I didn't want to go.
Did you tell her about all of the testing and so on, and interrogation that you went there?
Yes.
All right.
And then I told her, well, I said, maybe this is the end of it. And she said, I wonder if it has, I asked her, I said, I wonder if this has anything to do with the flight that I was on from Washington to Roswell Air Force. But she says, if it is, don't say anything, because there's been quite a few people eliminated. And
meaning related to the JFK assassination.
Right. So this was just about a year later.
All right.
And I said, well, I'm not going to say anything. We've already, prior to going up there, we had to sign those secrecy documents. And I said, I'm not going to say anything about it. And in February, here I get a set of orders.
February of what year?
Of 1965.
All right.
I get a set of orders, and they were directing me to report to Las Vegas, Nevada, and had a telephone number.
All right, and do you have a copy of those orders here?
Yes, I believe. All right. This is a... yeah, it's dated 23rd February 1965.
All right, and?
Advised me to report to Las Vegas, Nevada, and gave me a telephone number.
And I placed this document, which carries the number 11, in the lower right-hand corner. Is that correct?
Yes.
And this is the order to which you've just referred.
Right.
And interpret it again for us. What did it order you to do?
Report to Las Vegas, Nevada, and it has a telephone number there to call when I arrived.
All right. And did you know what facility it was in Las Vegas, Nevada, or did you have any other information when you received these orders?
No, I did not.
All right.
But since I had been to Langley, I kind of felt that it had something to do with them, or the CIA.
All right. So what did you do upon receiving this order?
Well, immediately I put my house up for sale. It gave us so many days to report there. And a couple came out and looked at it and says, okay, we'll take it. And says, we'll make arrangements to meet you at the First National Bank. I believe this was on a Sunday, and about 3 days later, and we met them over there and signed all the documents. And
all right. How long was your house on the market for sale?
About 1 week. I just got it in the paper.
And so it was sold very abruptly?
Yes. All right. Immediately.
And the people that bought your house, do you recall their names?
No, I don't. I guess the First National Bank would have their names, but...
All right. As far as you know, they weren't connected with any government agency. Is that correct?
Well, I didn't think they were, no.
All right. In any event, you sold your house very rapidly. What about the price on the house?
There was no dickering. They paid what I asked.
I see. So then what happened to you and your family or wife?
Well, Captain Cole told me that he was a kind of a liaison man between them and me. He said, well, this company will be out there to pack you and take care of your household goods. He says, you don't have to do a thing. Just leave everything in where it's at, except take what personal items you want to take with you. I said, well, how long is it going to be before we get these items? He says, they'll be waiting on you in Las Vegas by the time you get there.
So all of this was handled for you?
Yes.
The selling of your house, the packing of your personal clothing and items?
I run an ad in the paper to house for sale, and gave the address. And whenever this couple called and said they'd like to come out and see it, they came out, and I said, we'd like to have it. And then I'd financed it through the VA and the bank, First National Bank, was handling the loan on it. So all we did was go down there and sign the documents and turn it over to them. I had all the utilities cut off, too.
All right. So then you moved to Las Vegas?
Yes, we left there then to go to Las Vegas. When we got out to Las Vegas, I called this number, but I didn't get an answer. So we got a motel, and I kept calling this number, but no answer. And we got a little worried about what's going on. And later in that evening, I called it again, and this guy told me, he told me another name of a motel to go up there and sign in, and all expenses would be taken care of.
You're still in Las Vegas?
I'm still in Las Vegas.
All right, go ahead.
And this I did. I went up there and signed in at this motel that he gave us the address and name of. And we were there for about 3 or 4 days. And he said he'd get in contact with me. But I never received any message. And about 4 days, he finally contacted me and said that he would be at his home there in Las Vegas at 7 o'clock Sunday night.
Was this an Air Force officer?
I didn't know who it was at the time. But when I got out to his house, I found out it was an Air Force senior master sergeant.
All right.
And he's the one that told me that this, where I would be working and where it would be a CIA project.
All right. That's the first information you had as to where you were going to end up.
Right.
Okay.
And that my wife would be living in Las Vegas, and where I could find a house real reasonable for rent. And when to go up there and how to get there. He says they'll have your name at the main gate in Mercury, and then each gate thereafter they'll have your information on you. So you just drive on through and they'll point, show you where to go.
All right. When you say Mercury, you're referring to a little town in Nevada?
North of Las Vegas, Nevada. About, I guess about 40 miles up there, around 35, right. 40.
And so did you then end up at a base out there?
Yes. I went up that Monday morning after I went over to his house, and they took a picture of me there, and Mercury, it was Atomic Energy Commission, has an office right there at the gate, and I was to report in there, and I went in there, and they took a picture and gave me a badge, and then I went through their test site, part of it. There was another gate. This guy took that badge and gave me another one, and I went on to another gate, and another gate. I had 4 or 5 gates.
Did they exchange badges at every gate?
Each time.
Each time.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Then I wound up at a place looked just like an Air Force base, except small. It had some housing, housing that does, and they didn't have any barracks. It was all housing, and with rooms in them, made for personnel.
All right. What then type of planes did you learn were flown out of this base?
Well, when I first reported in, they gave me a brief, and they told me that this was the home of the U-2 spy plane, and that they were now using the Blackbird, which is the SR-71.
All right.
And that's what the project was all about.
And did you see those planes then as you worked on this base?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have on the easel another map. This one depicting the state of Nevada. Is that correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I'm pointing to Las Vegas here in the lower right-hand corner. And would you point to the approximate area where you think this base was located?
This base was located in this near Groom Lake, right on Groom Lake. And there was two ways out. One this way, coming down through Mercury and going out. And you could go out the back gate if there was some testing going on here, if you had to, you know, go home for any reason.
And you have placed a yellow mark there showing
the road leading out to that road there.
All right.
And without an aerial photo, this is about as close as I can come.
All right. Now, what were your duties on this base?
I was the administrative supervisor for base supply.
Did you ever receive orders confirming your location there?
No.
All right.
When I retired in June, not when I retired in September of 1966, this is my retirement orders, and it shows an address and post office box in Bowling Air Force Base in Washington, D.C. It has no references, I can tell, of Las Vegas or any other area around there. Referring to.
And this retirement order, which I'm holding up at this time, it has the number 12 in the lower right-hand corner.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Just to identify it. And again, this document does not refer specifically to this base that you just described.
No.
All right. Now, Mr. Vinson, did you serve out the remainder of your term at this base that you've just described?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any further interviews concerning your experience of November 22nd, 1963, by any person while you were still in the Air Force?
No.
Then, upon your retirement and discharge, where did you go?
I went to Long Beach, California, where I took a job with a CPA firm.
You lived there for a while?
Well, from September until January.
Of what year?
Of 67.
And then where did you go?
I went to Wichita, Kansas.
Why did you make the change?
I had an offer from a CPA firm here in Wichita, which were Mobley, West, Jennings, and Shaw.
All right. And then so you moved here and worked here in Wichita, Kansas?
Yes. I worked for them until March the 10th, I believe, 8th, March the 8th, when I found that the city of Wichita was looking for a person, and I went over and filled my application out and took a job with them.
Doing what?
I was administrative supervisor down at the maintenance facility.
All right. For the city of Wichita?
Mm-hmm. And yes.
Okay. Now, Mr. Vinson, when did you cease that employment with the city of Wichita?
I retired from the city of Wichita in, I believe, in 1987, after 22 years and so many months of service.
Now, following that retirement, where did you go?
From Air Force or from Wichita?
From the Wichita employment. Did you stay in Wichita for a while?
Oh, yes. I stayed in Wichita until 94, November of 94.
And then you moved out of state where you reside now.
Yes.
Now, Mr. Vinson, what was it that prompted you to come forward with the story of the events that you've just described for us?
I didn't say anything to the fact that I'd signed those secrecy documents for all that period of time. It was on my mind, but I felt that I better not until I read in the paper where that they had released all the documents that the CIA, not all of them, but a big percentage of them.
All right, now
30,000, I think, or something like that, of the Kennedy assassination.
All right, you're referring, I believe, then, to the legislation that was passed by the Congress and signed by President Bush, creating the Assassinations Record and Review Board?
Yes.
All right, and upon reading and learning about that, did you make any inquiry of anyone before you made any public statement about your experience?
Yes, I first talked to Larry Hatterberg about it.
And who is he?
He worked for Channel 10.
Here in Wichita.
Cape TV.
All right.
And I told him my concerns about the secrecy part of it. And he said, well, I'll check into it. And I guess he called Congressman Glickman and talked to him about it. And he told him that it would be all right. He saw nothing wrong with it, but due to the fact that legislative document pertained to the release of those that information.
All right. Now, at that time, Congressman Glickman was head of the House Intelligence Oversight Committee. Is that
yes,
correct?
Uh-huh. He identified it that that's what he was in charge of.
Did you ever talk to Congressman Glickman personally?
Yes, he called me and asked me if I was concerned about that, and I told him yes, I was. And he said, well, don't worry about that. He said, I'll take care of it if anything comes up in regard to that. He said that should be public information now as far as we're concerned. And I thanked him, and then I met with Larry Hatterberg, and he had some girl working for him. They did a story in Lederberg's People, and then they did a TV interview, and that's when you saw
yes
from the TV interview that I had with Larry Hatterberg.
Right. Now, the Glickman you're referring to is the current member of the President's Cabinet and the Secretary of Agriculture. Is that correct?
Yes.
It's the same Glickman.
Same Glickman.
All right. Now, Mr. Vinson, just one or two other questions here. When you were describing the individuals that got onto the C-54 after it landed in southern Dallas in the Trinity floodplain, you referred to one of the individuals that seemed to resemble Oswald. Which person was this?
He was a short one. He was probably 5'6", 7", right in there. He had black hair.
And he was a Caucasian.
A Caucasian.
And the larger man that you said weighed around 200 pounds.
He was a Latin of descent, which I would say more. He was more Cuban than the others. Latimer, they're pretty good size. The other Latins that I know or seen or anything to do with are a little shorter.
All right. Now, Mr. Vinson, this information and these statements you have made here today, are they true?
True to the best of my knowledge and belief.
And do you say that under penalties of perjury?
Yes, or whatever.
All right. Now, you have requested that I file a Freedom of Information Act request on the CIA, did you not?
Yes.
And I did that, did I not?
Yes.
And you have not yet today been informed by the CIA that your records are going to be produced. Is that a correct statement?
That is correct.
All right. They have acknowledged the request, but nothing else has happened.
That's
is that
right.
a fair way to put
That's
it?
That's right.
And that was over a year ago.
Yes.
Mr. Vinson, I don't have any further questions of you. Are you willing to testify under oath to these facts that you have just stated?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
One of the many emails I received after last week's episode was from a listener asking me where is the spot located today that Robert Vinson says the C-54 landed and picked up a Latin man and a possible Lee Harvey Oswald double. I've been to this exact area many times. One of the times I was there was back in the fall of 1996 with my friend and mentor Penn Jones Jr. The area is best found by locating the Eloise Lundy Recreation Center that is located near the Trinity River. If you want to see the spot on a satellite map, the address is 1228 Reverend C.B.T. Smith Street in Dallas. There is a baseball field at this recreation center, and about 300 feet from that field over the levee is the spot where Sergeant Vinson said that the plane landed that day that possibly played a part in changing history. Next week on The End of Innocence, the JFK assassination, we will continue our series we are calling the JFK Assassination Hills to Die On. Next week, we will talk about the fact that we know that Lee Harvey Oswald was not on the 6th floor of the Texas School Book Depository Building when the shots were fired. That's a hill I choose to die on, and I'll tell you why next week. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the 61st anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.